Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 117 for April 18th, 2010. Bob Jacobson.
Floss Weekly is brought to you by Drobo, the original S Pro, and the new Drobo Elite, offering expandable storage products for individuals, small businesses, and creative teams. For more information and instant rebates, visit drobo.com/floss.
It's time for Floss Weekly, the weekly show about free, libre, and open source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, and with me this week as my co-host is... Oh, look, nobody else here. We have a very important show today. We're going to talk to Bob Jacobson. He's a tenured professor in experimental physics at UC Berkeley, but in his spare time, he's also the administrator of the JMRI open source project, and this is software, open source software to control model trains. And because of his involvement with this JMRI software, he got involved in a very long-running, something like 6 years now, legal case. And it's a very important legal case because it set up an important precedent for all open source licenses and their enforceability. The most important thing is that giving your code away for free, as in beer, doesn't mean you give up your rights to enforce the license that may come along with your free software. At the end of the conversation, he's going to have some important advice for all open source projects. So give a strong listen to this one.
We'll be right back with more Floss Weekly in just a moment, but first a word from Drobo, D-R-O-B-O, the Data Robotics, the amazing storage product, ever-expanding line of storage products from Drobo. If you go to drobo.com/floss, there's a great website where you can learn more about the Drobo offerings, including the original Drobo, the Drobo S, the Drobo Pro, the new Drobo Elite, and the even newer Drobo FS, drobo.com/floss for deals. It'll save you as much as $75 to, I think, $400 on your new Drobo. Drobo stands for Data Robotics, and they created this amazing four-drive container enclosure that allows you to easily swap in new drives and rebuild it. Because of redundancy, you can lose a drive and still put another drive and never lose a bit. Great for home users to store iTunes libraries or movies or photo collections, family videos, or for backup. Then there's a newer Drobo S that has five drives. They can be heterogeneous, by the way, and it just adds them all up. Better performance for creative professionals, of course, more storage. With these, you know, 2 terabyte drives, 5 drives, that could be 10 terabytes. Wow. The Drobo Pro for small businesses and creative teams, 8 disk bays. The new Drobo Elite, 8 bays, but also it's a SAN. It's a storage area network which supports up to 16 computer connections with dual gigabit Ethernet ports for connecting to hosts using iSCSI. It's great for video editing. It's VMware certified. In fact, a lot of the Drobos are used for virtualization. They're really great for that. If you need capacity, if you need USB 2, FireWire 800, Gigabit Ethernet, iSCSI, if you need performance, you need a Drobo. Safe, expandable storage for everybody. The new Drobo FS 2, which has 2 processors, runs Linux. It can run Linux programs and be a NAS. It's amazing. Just go to drobo.com/floss to learn more, to see Drobo in action and get some great prices on the Drobo with instant rebates. Or call 866-97-DROBO. Drobo. Drobo.com/floss. And now we return you to Floss Weekly.
Let's get him on now from Berkeley, California. With me on the Skype line here today is Mr. Robert Bob Jacobson. Greetings. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And do you prefer Robert or Bob?
Everybody calls me Bob.
Everybody calls you Bob, even those people who like you or don't like you, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's really good. So I wanted to start first, before we get into all the meat of the real reason we're chatting today, I wanted to start first with sort of get a little background on you. Who are you? What have you been doing with your life? And how did you get involved with open source?
Well, my day job is a physics professor, a researcher and teacher. The official open source work I do is all part of my hobby, which is model railroads. But as an academic, as a researcher, there's a whole bunch of sharing of code and informal open source and that kind of stuff that we do. I mean, I'm here at Berkeley. You can't get away from the idea of sharing code when you're at Berkeley. It's just built into the ethos here.
Especially since that's the original source of the Berkeley software distribution, which became all the NetBSD and FreeBSD stuff that we use all over the place now.
That's exactly right. And you know, it's a very reasonable thing for researchers to do is to, you know, we'll fight each other to the death over funding and over results, but we share our tools all the time. And software patches and improvements and things like that are a good way to make your reputation. If you can make the computers dance and produce new physics results or any other kind of result, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Very cool. So trains, how did trains get in the middle of that?
Well, you know, there's a difference between the day job and the hobby. And
the, yeah.
You know, and I've always liked trains. And when my kids reached a certain age, we started working on model railroads. It turns out that you may remember model trains from when you were younger. They're become a lot more high-tech than they used to be.
You know, I was just going to think about that because I remember my last experience with trains, model trains, was probably, I'm going to say probably a good 15 to 20 years ago. And I remember that part of the complication was if you ever had a loop that went backwards, you had to, like, wire your entire train set so that it had this big reverser switch on it and everything.
That's right. And you couldn't bring two trains close to each other because once they were on the same piece of track, they saw the same voltage and their motors would do the same thing. And
there were these very complex switches to say, are you on cab one or cab two or cab three? And
you
that.
Remember the terminology.
Too. I do. Well, you know, we had a pretty big layout in our family room. So, I mean, it wasn't huge, but it was a nice thing. And it had a big reverser switch. And we only had one. I think we had two controllers, but it was sort of, it was like maybe only like 10 blocks. So it was kind of cool.
Well, model trains have gone through the same technological revolution everything else has. If you think of the track in a model train as sort of a party line that can talk electrically to a locomotive, if you put a digital communication stream on that and a little microcomputer in each engine, you can tell them all what you want them to do. So now they're actually called decoders, but they're really little microcontrollers in every locomotive. And you can send them streams that say, go fast, go slow, turn on your lights, sound your horn. These same processors can make very realistic sounds. It's basically moved the capability up a whole bunch in realism. So now you don't have to think about the wiring. You can just send through this digital communication stream what you want the models to do.
So instead of having the voltage on the track be varied to control the speed of the train, there's like just a constant voltage everywhere, and it kind of figures out which side is plus and which side is minus, and it just works, right?
Yeah, the technology is actually a lot like power over Ethernet. You've got a bit stream that's sending what I want you to do with it, but the raw voltage of the signal is being rectified and used to provide the power to the motor.
Oh, so are you sending digital signals then over the over the tracks themselves?
It's actually a plus-minus bit-oriented protocol that's sent back and forth. It's not at a very high rate. It's only a few tens of thousands of bits per second. But, you know, you're telling this engine to drive, and then it's going to do that for a few seconds. It's not like trying to get audio over it or something like that.
Okay.
So this kind of capability, the shorthand for it is digital command control, abbreviated DCC, lets you do a lot of stuff and brings in software. So the JMRI software that my friends and I started to write and has now become this open source project is just another layer of complexity. So in other words, letting you make realistic railroad signals or letting you make realistic control of the trains or making it easier to tell these decoders, which aren't very bright, exactly what you want them to do. So that instead of saying, oh, yeah, I want you to do your function 3 and then your function 7 and then do this other thing, you can say, sound the horn.
That's probably saves a little bit of time when you're trying to actually be realistic about it, though.
Yeah, and it hides a lot of the complexity. And, you know, model railroaders, some of us really like the computers, but other people like to paint things with their airbrushes, and other people are masters of trees.
Yes.
And a lot of them don't want to mess with computers.
So they just want to, and they just want to drive the trains around and make it all happen.
So having this kind of stuff is can actually, you know, make the thing more realistic in their eyes, even though they've got a modern computer in the background working pretty hard.
Now, was there this, as these various digital controls arrived, were they all the same standard, or did they somehow, was it all unified pretty early, or were there all these varying standards?
They unified pretty early. They unified in the mid-90s. Mm. There were seven or eight different competing standards, but you know, model railroading is not a huge industry. Even the big companies of model railroading are only a few technical people, and they figured out pretty quickly that if they all built interoperating parts, interoperating hardware, they could make money. So starting in about the mid-90s, the sort of the national hobby organization called the NMRA, National Model Railroad Association, mm-hmm. published a standard that a whole bunch of manufacturers started to implement hardware for, the little chips and stuff.
Okay.
But the higher level, how are we going to make this really work, there's never really been a standard there. That also is analogous to a lot of digital communications. I mean, the Ethernet protocols are pretty well standardized, but it took a long time for browsers to really become interoperable.
And so what is JMRI? Is it an attempt then to interface to all these things in a sort of a nice, easy way then?
So that's it. It sort of has a top view and a bottom view. At the looking up from the layout, it knows how to connect to just about every kind of popular model railroad hardware.
Mm-hmm. And what's JMRI stand for?
Java Model Railroad Interface.
Ah.
It's not the best acronym. I will agree with you from everybody says that. And I say, yeah, but you know, after 10 years, you sort of can't get away from it.
Do you pronounce it JAMRI or anything?
No, we just spell it JMRI.
Okay.
it's written in Java, which is where the J came from.
Sure.
At the time that it was first being written, you know, there was a time when Java wasn't ubiquitous. And every Java web page had a little thing on the bottom of it that said Java is not an acronym.
Right.
So all of our web pages had a little line on the bottom that says JMRI is an acronym.
Oh, that's cute. That's very cute.
Just out of, you know, contrariness, I think, more than anything else. And we've never really – it actually isn't. You can't pronounce it.
Mm.
But nevertheless, we try.
I'm surprised you didn't come up with some sort of coffee metaphor like everybody else did related to trains.
Yeah, I'm just not that creative.
Okay, great. So you produce JMRI as an open source project. Did you have a lot of people working on it at the time?
We have. Well, it comes and goes. I mean, mm-hmm. It obviously started with just a few people. I was actually not the original. If you really trace back all the little pieces that came together to do this,
mm-hmm.
there were a couple other people who'd been working on it before I arrived. In the year 2000, 2001, it pulled together a bunch of threads of things that people had been writing over the prior 5 years,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, that's a metaphor for a lot of open source projects. They pull together the work of a lot of people.
Sure.
And the real reason that JMRI has progressed so fast is there are a lot of people who walk up and say, you know, I've got this little piece that I'd like to merge into it. It's sort of a stone soup approach to development.
Yeah, so this is an open source project. You have it hosted on, is it SourceForge?
It's on SourceForge, yeah.
Okay, so there are people that know well of this project and are contributing to it and are using it in their own hobby situations and are providing feedback and generating it. What's the size of the community before we bring in the next factor here?
Well, the it's hard to know the number of users because, of course, open source can go anywhere, but
sure.
it's upwards of tens of thousands of people.
Okay, so it's well established that this is an open source project and everybody's sharing it. What was the license at that point?
The original license was the artistic license.
Is that Perl's artistic license?
Yes.
And this was artistic one right before 2 came out, right?
That's correct. And in fact, we picked that. Myself and another guy picked that in 2000, mostly because we liked the name. And, you know, there is a certain, we were both academics, and there is a certain, you know, like to play with words thing going on there. But also, we didn't really understand that licenses were important.
Yes, I imagine this all became clearer later.
Yeah. No, we didn't, you know, I don't think anybody gave a lot of thought to the fact that the details mattered. We mostly gave thought to the fact that we should pick one so people know that we're serious about this.
And who owned the copyright? Was it still individuals that owned the copyright?
At that point, because we hadn't done anything formal, all the people who wrote pieces of it owned the copyrights of their pieces.
And it was clear to everybody contributing, though, that they were contributing to the project, and the project had the artistic license.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And what we would tell people is that, you know, you... when you give this in, we're very happy and we'll put you up on our names, the name of our contributors, but we're going to distribute this stuff under the artistic license.
Okay, okay. Now, so I think we've got enough background at this point. So enter Katzer. Talk about that.
So model railroading is not a very big place. Everybody knows everybody, and very few people can make a lot of money that way. And, you know, it's a classic example of the saying, the best way to make a big, best way to make a small fortune in model railroading is to start with a big one.
Yeah.
And but there were a few software vendors who were really vendors who were selling the stuff. Mm-hmm. There, you know, open source in the 2000 was not in the popular culture. Nobody knew that name. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of hobbyists who were handing their stuff out. So, you know, you like this piece of code, someone would give it to you. It's our hobby. Why not?
Sure.
So we were on one end of the spectrum because we were formally open source. We had a license. We were hosted on the web. You could get it. And this caused some tension because people could go somewhere. There were three or four companies that were really three or four people on the other end who would sell you stuff ranging from $50 to $500 to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And one day out of the blue, I get a letter from this person whose name is Matthew Katzer that he has a patent that covers stuff that JMRI does, and he wants $200,000 for licensing. Yeah, that was pretty much my reaction.
What? WTF?
Yeah. Well, you know, I had actually met Matt. He and I he's actually up by you. He's in Portland.
Okay.
And but, you know, that means that we don't run into each other on the street, but we had met each other at conventions and we'd exchanged a few emails.
Well, you said that the community is small for this stuff, right? Especially when you're talking about software related to these things.
Everybody knows everybody.
So you'd met him. Did you have any kind of friendly relationship with him, or you just sort of knew him as an acquaintance?
It was an acquaintance. Okay. I mean, I think we'd probably only talked in person two or three times at most. And over email maybe once or twice. I don't even remember the how early that was, but over the intervening few years. This was a few years ago now.
So we can't attribute any of the letter you got to any kind of personal mismatch somewhere.
Well, see now, so it depends a little bit on when we understand this. At the time I got that letter, that I really didn't know what the story was.
Okay.
Here. Matt had gotten in arguments with JMRI people, although not so much with me, over a couple of things that had happened in the past.
Ah, so there was a bit of history even leading up to this.
Yeah, so the primary JMRI itself is actually a couple of different applications, which are really just skins on a Java jar file. And the one that most people know is called Decoder Pro.
Okay.
That's the name that a model railroader would know it as. Mm-hmm. Well, Matt had registered decoderpro.com.
Mm.
And when this was discovered by somebody else, and there was sort of a firestorm on a non-JMRI mailing list, a mailing list for other kinds of model railroaders, Matt said that he thought that he would someday make a commercial product out of this, and he didn't see anything wrong with it.
Mm, okay.
Which just really fanned the flames.
Yes, yes, I can imagine.
Of this whole thing. But I thought that had died down.
Okay.
I really did. You know, sometimes there's a mistake. A lot of people don't understand open source. I think I would argue today that there are people who either accidentally or deliberately still don't understand open source.
Mm-hmm. So this had all happened prior to you receiving this letter demanding $200,000.
That's right.
Okay.
And so I wrote him back and I said, you know, I don't think you have a valid patent here. I believe in patents. I actually personally, not model railroad based, I have two patents through my work. I understand them, but I don't think you have a valid one.
So wait a second. He's claiming that he has a patent on the software that you claim you were producing through the open source project.
Well, you don't actually patent software, right? What you do is you patent a method or an algorithm that software then implements. And he claims that he has one that basically covers any kind of communication between more than one computer in order to run model trains.
Now going back in timeline, when could he have possibly filed this patent? Was it after the JMR project started?
Well, see, this is an interesting thing, and I'm not sure how far your audience wants to go into this, but the answer to that is both.
Okay.
So in the American patent system, there's this very interesting thing called a continuation.
Okay.
So if I file a patent, let's say I file a patent application today,
mm-hmm.
and then before it gets granted, which might take 2 years, I can file something called a continuation,
mm-hmm.
which is a new patent. It's a new set of claims, but it gets its priority date, the date that someone has to have invented before, from my original application.
Ew. Okay,
so Matt had an application from 1998, mm-hmm. and as recently as now, he is still continuing to write patents against this 1998 patent.
Now, so that initial thing obviously was not inspired by JMRI then.
No, it couldn't have been. Although so the longer history of this is that there were some people who in 1994 were running trains over the internet in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And some of their code actually made it into JMRI, you know, as open source work goes. But he didn't know that. And actually, to tell you the truth, that's not the primary part of the defense.
Yes.
That when we introduced this code, the stuff that he took offense to, he actually filed the specific patent that he was complaining about, you know, that he was writing to me about 5 days later.
Wow. Okay. So the timeline is that he gets to sort of start saying it's 1998, but really the stuff that's related to what you guys were doing was not until much later, until he'd already seen you guys doing it.
That's correct.
Okay. I understand.
Now, this is perfectly legal.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, what's legal does not make sense. I do not need to be convinced of this.
Right. So under the legal system, he's allowed to keep doing this. If he ever fails to keep filing new patents to keep the chain of continuations going, well then it stops. But you know, he's been willing to spend the money to do that,
mm-hmm.
and so he has these chains of patents, and he can pretty much write something that's targeted at anything that anybody writes.
Okay, so he's got this patent, he thinks, or actually not. It's not even really a real patent. It's a patent pending still, right?
No, at that point, it's really a patent. He waited long enough before he wrote me to make sure it got issued. He waited about roughly 2 years before he wrote me.
Okay, so it's issued, and yet it predates back to 98, even though the stuff that was your stuff didn't get added until after he saw your stuff.
That's correct. And just to add some more wonderful texture to this, I actually didn't write the code he was complaining about.
Ah, okay.
That was, you know, contributed by somebody in New Zealand, but he can't go after him.
But he sends you this six-figure bill, and what was your response?
Holy shit.
Okay. Bleep, bleep, bleep. But okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Well, it was actually worse than that because my wife opened the envelope.
Oh, that can't be good.
And it's like, you know, it's almost a stereotype, but everybody's hobbies take time away from their families, and there's always a balance there. And then the idea that I'm not rich, this is way more money than I conceivably have.
I know the feeling. If I've been in similar situations, I know exactly where you're at.
It's not even a question of writing a check. You know, I could sell my house and not be able to raise that much money.
Exactly. So did you write a response? Did you a phone call? Or is there a series of responses?
The first thing I did was to just, since it was a formal letter, it wasn't from Matt. It was from his lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I figured that I better write a formal letter back. And
okay.
So that's what I did. And basically what I said was, you know, you got to point at the thing that you think is a problem because I don't think anything that we do is patentable.
Okay.
Words to that effect. And the actual letters are all up on the website if your listeners want to take a look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hear anything back for a little while. And then I got another letter saying, yes, we do. And incidentally, we've raised the price and we're going to charge you interest. And this went on for a little while. But, you know, I figured, you know, maybe I'm sounding a little bit naive here, but I figured that, well, okay, we can write letters back and forth for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did something that basically put me in a corner from which I had no choice.
Right.
So, right, I'm an academic, and about the only thing I can get fired for is academic. I have tenure at Berkeley, which is, you know, a pretty good gig.
Mm-hmm.
But I can get fired for doing academically dishonest things.
Okay.
That's about it. If I were to claim somebody else's work as my own, that's about it. I mean, there are a lot of other pretty disreputable things that faculty can get away with, but they can't get away with that.
Right, right.
And specifically written into my contract is allegations of patent infringement are sufficient.
Mm.
Not proof of, allegations of.
Yeah.
So Matt, in October of this year, of that year, sent a Freedom of Information Act request to my lab saying a bunch of things that aren't true. He talked about the fact that I was being sued, which wasn't true. He talked about the fact that he had evidence that the lab was involved in this infringement of this patent, which wasn't true.
Mm.
And he wanted an accounting of all the money that the lab had provided for the development of this software, which didn't exist.
Mm.
And this was like, you know, I got called on the carpet immediately, and it was not a pleasant experience. And I just had this image of Katzer continuing to do stuff like this because he was basically out of control.
Okay.
So I did two things. I contacted the Electronic Frontier Foundation to ask them if they knew of anybody who'd be willing to help me, and they put me in touch with a lawyer by the name of Victoria Hall, who is just fantastic at this stuff. And I owe her a tremendous debt of gratitude. And I also learned how to actually use the technology of the legal system to find out if I was being sued. And I discovered that Katzer had done this to two people before.
That's interesting. About software like GMRI?
Yeah. Remember I mentioned earlier that there were a couple of individuals who had little tiny businesses selling the stuff for $50 and things like that?
Okay.
Well, he had sued both of those over patents before. Ooh. And he had abandoned the suit when their lawyers had gotten when they'd gotten lawyers and gotten in touch with him and pointed out that he didn't have any prior art. His patents weren't valid. So Victoria worked with me to try and do that strategy, and it didn't work. And we became convinced that Katzer was about to raise the stakes again, which would have been really, really bad. So we filed this thing called a request for a declaratory judgment. And I'm not a lawyer. I don't always get the terminology right. But basically, you're asking a judge to say, well, you know, he hasn't sued me yet, but I still want you to rule as to whether this patent is valid or not.
Sure.
And this started a four-year odyssey of, well, life in the federal courts.
Wait, 4 years?
Yeah, it was just about 4 years. It's been 4 years now. It was not quite 4 years when the thing finally settled.
So this is like you filing and him filing and you appearing in court and then the court getting set over and back you bringing witnesses. Is he bringing witnesses, that sort of thing, for 4 years?
You know, and there's actually a lesson here for other small and independent, I mean, not funded by IBM, open source projects, which is that the legal system is not your friend. Right? You will eventually win. But the other side has a huge number of roadblocks that they can throw in your way.
Yes, I have personal experience with that with my own legal case. I'm very, very sympathetic at this point.
Yeah, you know, that you would think that your sweetness and light is on your side and you have a huge array of facts and that'll be sufficient. Let's get it done before lunch. But it just doesn't work that way.
And so what was the result of all of this back and forth? What did the court finally decide declaratory judgment?
Well, with respect to the patent stuff, right before Katzer had to sort of put up or shut up with respect to whether we infringed or not, and we actually thought that since we didn't infringe and he had been accusing us of this, we were going to win big on this, he did something called disclaiming the patent, which is you're allowed to do this. You're allowed to tell the patent office, oops, my bad, pretend this never happened. And so the particular one he'd been accusing me of went away. It's gone. He can't accuse anybody else of a problem with that now.
Ugh.
Yeah. But since at this point he's got about a dozen other ones, we were still pretty exposed. And also, at about the same time that all this was happening, we discovered the real reason for all of this, which is that Katzer wanted to use a big chunk of JMRI in his own products, not just to sell it to $50, but because he was making a deal with a large, but I can't name, company to sell them a product for a lot of money.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Okay.
And you know, that it's interesting. Model trains, real model trains, is not that big of a market. But Microsoft Train Simulator and the two independent versions of it are huge. So one could certainly imagine the possibility that one of those companies was interested in sort of crossing the boundary between the two and needed technology.
I could certainly see that. Okay, so
our working theory at that point was that Katzer wanted to win this thing so that the only way I could pay for it was to give him JMRI. He hadn't figured out at this point. He still doesn't understand to this day open source. The fact that I couldn't give him JMRI, it wasn't mine, I don't think he ever understood that.
So the judgment failed, right, at some level?
So the patent stuff failed, but we had discovered that he had copied all of this code.
Okay.
So we had a copyright case.
Ah, no, that was separate from the judgment, right?
It was part of the same case.
Okay.
Yeah, separate claim, separate issue. And that one, the judge ruled against us because there was nothing in the law as he read it that allowed us to take action against Katzer because, quote, we were giving the software away, end quote.
So because there was a zero-cost license associated with this, even though it said copyright individual person over all the files, you still don't have a copyright claim because it was free as in beer.
That's right. And of course, you know, as I'm sure the listeners and you can imagine, Katzer is doing his best to blow smoke in front of the distinction between free as in beer and free as in speech.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. So the judge at the district court said, basically, you don't have a case now because even if it was copyrighted, it doesn't matter. You can't be any damages ever because you're giving away for free anyway.
Right, and federal courts are not interested in dealing with things that don't have any damages because they say, I mean, what's the point?
Yeah, okay, great.
I can't award you anything.
Now, so at the heart of this then is you having not been able to get across the point of what an open source license is about.
Right, and so when we lost this part of the decision, we decided that and this is a real commitment of time on the part of Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
We decided we would appeal this to what's called the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. It's the main intellectual property court in the United States. It's in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Is that sort of between that and the Supreme Court? It's sort of the step in between?
Yeah. In the American legal system, you really only have two layers. There's the regular district courts, there's an appeals court, and there's the Supreme Court.
Okay. All right.
And most things can't go to the Supreme Court because they pick and choose.
Yes. Okay. So you're appealing this case. You're coming back now. I think the little bit of legal stuff I know means to make an appeal, you have to make an argument that something failed, the process failed, or something at the level of the district court. Then, right?
Yeah. The district court got it wrong.
Okay.
In this particular case, the argument for the appeal was based on the fact that the district court had misunderstood what the law says.
Okay. Great. So you filed this appeal. How long ago was this?
Oh, let's see. This would have been 2.5 years ago.
Okay, great. And so you take this to the appeals court. And I understand there was a Friends of the Court brief with some pretty famous people contributing to that.
Right. A lot of very, very intelligent and well-spoken people from open source organizations got together. I think there were seven organizations on the brief, although I'd have to go back and count. And they basically argued that open source is economically important and that when you're allowing someone to use it under those terms, that's not at all the same as allowing them to claim it as their own, and you'd have to pay somebody a lot of money to take their name off something.
Yeah, from your website, I got the list here. Creative Commons Corp, the Linux Foundation, the Open Source Initiative, the Software Freedom Law Center, yet another society, which, of course, is the Pearl Foundation, and the Wikimedia Foundation.
That's a pretty good list of names, isn't it?
You can't get better than that in terms of open source. That pretty much defines it right there.
And the reason for this is that you know, it's just by trick of chance, this Model Railroad case was the one that first brought up this issue of, does open source have a legal standing, a legal context in which it can enforce its licenses?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we a contract? Are we a license? Exactly what kind of license? Because it's not signed. You know, the lawyers can speak at great length about the uncertainties here.
Mm-hmm.
But in the American system, until some judge has decided, it's just theory.
So
you have a precedent. It's just theory.
So the materials generated for that court brief probably are pretty foundational, pretty fundamental then. It might be good for anybody involved in open source even just to review that brief then.
Reviewing our brief and the what's called the amicus brief, the one from all those organizations, and really reviewing the decision of the court,
mm-hmm,
would give you a very good idea of really where this stuff stands in the American legal system.
Great. Okay.
And there are some tricky bits. One of the things that I've learned is that the law is not like code. In code, you can iteratively improve things until you get it right.
Mm-hmm.
In law, you do it once and you have to live with it.
Exactly.
And one word in a license can make all the difference in the world. So the bottom line here is, for your listeners, is don't write your own license.
Oh, completely not. You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because I remember there was some early discussion since I've been in the Pearl community for 20 years about the artistic one, and that Larry even at one point said that he had some lawyers look over it after he had written it had been used everywhere, that it was almost unenforceable.
That's correct.
So it's interesting actually what it says to the credit for the open source community is that even the nearly most unenforceable license was enforceable.
That's right.
So everything else has got some
pretty good
standing.
You can make life harder for yourself with a bad license or easier with a good one, but the basic standing of the idea of open source, we're letting you use this at no cost, but we put restrictions on it, that's now established.
So what was the length of the process with the appeals court? Was that something that was like a 3-month thing?
No, it was about 18 months.
Oh, Now, what were you doing in the midst of this? Were you still on staff at Berkeley? You were still teaching? You were still going through your day job?
I have two day jobs. At this point, I actually had an extra half day job because I had some expenses I had to pay.
Well, obviously, yeah. So you're flying back to Washington from time to time, I presume? And
I only had to go out there once for that. I mean, most of the appeals process, in fact, most of the legal process is paper. So you spend a huge amount of time reading things. And, you know, lawyers are good at law, but it takes a long time to get them to understand the facts. And they want to understand the facts. They try very hard, but it's sort of an alien realm. And so you have to spend a lot of time making sure the documents are actually right, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So this takes a long time, but I understand that actually came in your favor. By the time this all cleared, you got what you wanted. What does that mean in terms of the legal process at this point?
Well, the detail of it is they send it back down to the original district judge and say, no, this is the right way to think about it. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we lost again, and we filed another appeal because the judge argued something that ended up not mattering in the end.
No, wait a second. So the appeals court said the first district court screwed up. So you go back to district court to start again, and now something else screws up?
That's right. And so the second time around, the judge said, yes, we were asking for an injunction, something that says you can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge says, but basically, we think that the judge got the standard wrong. He applied the wrong rules. He said, you need to be able to show us that everybody already has been damaged, not will be damaged if Katzer continues.
Oh, okay. That's kind of hard to prove.
You know, that's really hard to prove. But in the meantime, the rest of the case moved on, and we were able to – there's a process in the legal system called discovery. If you get far enough along in a case, you can ask to see documents from the other person. And this is a mixed blessing.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, one of the things that Katzer did at this point is he bought – the copyright to a manual for one of these decoders from a company for $500.
Okay.
And he sued me for $6 million. Yes, that's correct. $6 million. Because somebody, not me, had copied some phrases out of that manual into one of the screens we show when operating these decoders.
Okay.
And the Katzer's claim is, well, if what I did was a copyright violation, then this is.
Okay.
And it turns out that this caused another delay. We actually had permission from the original author of the manual, and there was a whole bunch of things. But finally, this discovery process enabled us to figure out what was going on and put a motion before the judge to settle a whole bunch of factual things.
Okay.
Now we had real documents, and the judge ruled right down the line for us.
And what does that include?
So it includes that Katzer, in fact, although he denied it, that he did copy our stuff.
Okay.
That we did have a license for the stuff we used.
Mm-hmm.
That Katzer suing for $6 million was, the word that's actually used is inequitable.
Mm.
You don't call it illegal, but inequitable is as good as it gets.
Sure.
That, and here's an interesting one, that Katzer had violated the DMCA, the law that everybody loves to hate, when he'd taken our copyrighted notices out of our code.
Now, wait a second. Were you arguing the DMCA at any point in here?
Yeah, we were actually arguing the DMCA. Part of the DMCA, not the part about website hosting, but there's another part that says you're not allowed to take out copyright management information.
Mm, okay.
For example, it's not just a violation of copyright for me to take something you've written and use it without permission.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a violation of copyright for me to take that thing, take out the copyright notice and further distribute it.
Okay. All right.
Right. So I can't, it's not really a copying because I'm not making extra copies. Even if I take the original, sand your name off the disc and then sell it to somebody else as my own, that's a DMCA violation.
Wow. That's pretty strong.
That's actually very good for model. Well, not just model railroads, but open source because we put our names on things.
Yes. Yes.
And we, one of the things we get is that our name is on something that you know, we did this. You should think highly of us.
Now, I also understand the cyber squatting was part of this ruling as well.
Yeah, we won that one too. Katzer claimed that it was okay for him to take decoderpro.com. His argument was basically because we weren't using it.
Okay.
Which is sort of a spurious thing.
Now, you had a trademark on that at some point?
Yeah, we trademarked the name decoderpro. In part, we trademarked it not because of that. We trademarked it because at one point Katzer had some of his distributors sell his software under our name.
And he hadn't bothered getting the trademark on that yet, huh?
Yeah, thank God.
So you had like one little way that you could kind of backdoor that. That's great.
Yeah, we got that in time.
Now, did the WIPO get involved on that?
Yeah, so if someone steals your domain name, you have two choices. You can go to court, and since we were already in court, we used it there. Or you could go to through this thing called the UDRP, the Uniform Domain Resolution Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure that's what it stands for. And so you can go to the World Intellectual Property Organization, and they will put an arbitrator on it who will make a decision as to whether somebody had registered something in bad faith.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a very strong statement from them that this thing had been registered in bad faith.
And you're able to carry that back to the court and say, well, this is part of the thing that's interesting.
That you can carry back to the domain registrar and get your domain name back.
Oh, okay.
So we did that, and then also at the same time we carried it back to the court as evidence. You know, so there's just a huge number of legal tricks, and if somebody is determined to stall, as Katzer was,
mm-hmm.
it's really hard to fight that. So the reason we had to go to WIPO to handle this was that Katzer was arguing that, you know, who was the right person to own this domain name.
Mm, okay.
And rather than spend a year sorting out who actually was, even though I was the holder of the trademark because I had filed the paperwork, we went to WIPO. It costs $1,500, but it's pretty quick.
So basically the JMRI code that you had is copyrightable, and Katzer damaged the JMRI project even though you're giving away this stuff for free.
Right.
He cyber squatted
our name off.
He cyber squatted DecoderPro.com.
Right.
He infringed the copyrights by distributing his stuff even though it was your copyright.
That's right.
And you didn't infringe on the QMI manual because
that's right.
Or QSI manual, sorry. And he violated the DMCA.
That's right.
So that's straight down the board, all in
your
favor.
That was pretty much straight down the board. But now we had a problem because mm-hmm. that list doesn't include patents.
Mm.
And so sitting out there were roughly a dozen patents that he could change. He had told the court that he wasn't going to enforce his patents, but we didn't want to really have to fight that again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this takes a lot of time and it costs a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So the two choices at that point are, do you go to court in late spring and, you know, sort of get a final jury verdict where they bang the gavel and say guilty, 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 or do you try and work out something?
Okay.
And I went, after a lot of back and forth, we worked something out. We got him to pay not all of my costs, but basically pay most of my costs and give everybody involved in JMRI, not just me, a release against patent liability.
So there's a hold harmless, basically, for all of JMRI's participants.
Right.
There's a
anybody
settlement.
Who used it or developed it, he can't go after them for anything.
And there's also apparently an injunction against him for misstating facts in the future?
That's right.
So he has to be quiet.
Well, he's allowed to talk. I mean, freedom of speech is important.
Right.
But what he's not allowed to do is to distribute JMRI stuff as his own or misuse our copyrights or anything like that. And the reason we got that is to make it much easier to hold him responsible if he goes back to his old ways.
And
he says he's not going to go back to his old ways. I hope he doesn't go back.
At this point, I wouldn't trust him very far.
It would be great if he wrote software instead of making trouble.
Yeah, okay. And also, apparently, you set up procedures for future disagreement, like mediation and loser pays and things like that.
That's right. And again, if he does what he says he's going to do, which is to just write software instead of using the legal system against people, none of that will matter. But if he doesn't, it makes it much more straightforward, much quicker to hold him responsible.
Okay, now here's the thing. To a lot of our listeners, having won $100,000 as part of this settlement is going to sound like a huge amount of money, but I understand that's not so big when you look at all the bills you got to pay.
Yeah, it's almost $30,000 less than it cost me.
So at this point, you're actually, and that's probably not even counting blood, sweat, and tears.
That's not counting blood, sweat, and tears at all, nor the blood, sweat, and tears of a bunch of lawyers who worked very hard.
Wow. So how did you manage to keep up with your actual expenses?
Well, I have a second and a third mortgage.
Oh, wow.
And the third one's been paid off. But
okay.
The second one, I still have a little ways to go. But, you know, to a certain extent, he didn't give me any choice, right? He threatened my career.
Right.
I spent 30 years getting to where I am today, and he tried to get me fired. What other choice did I have?
Now, did you solicit contributions along the way, and have people been able to step up to that?
People have been very, very generous, but you know, there's a limit to how many $10, $20, $50 donations this model railroading community can come up with. And it was, they were very, very generous, but and I was already counting that in the accounting that I gave you.
Yeah, I can understand that.
But you know, so the people wonder where the money goes. The money goes to things like court filings and stenographers for hearings, and just, you know, it's like that list of people at the end of the credits in a movie, all the people whose titles you haven't heard of that are necessary to make the movie work. The legal system is like that.
Oh, I remember on this one one part of my case, and you probably have similar stories to this, but on my case, I had my lawyer, my paralegal, their secretary, and we were on the phone to Singapore talking to my expert witness.
Right.
And I just saw all the little dials spinning at the same time in my head, not even counting the long distance call to Singapore back then. It was just, it was insane.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of people, all those foundations you listed, Bruce Perens, a bunch of other people wrote things that were extremely helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all the other people are doing this for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The stenographers, the videographers, the people who pull out the records, you know, they're doing it for a living, and you got to pay them.
So now, looking back, 2020 hindsight, is there anything you would have done differently? Any advice for people that might be in similar circumstances?
Yeah, I'll give you three pieces of advice, and none of them are going to sit well with technical people, but they're all true.
Mm-hmm.
One is register your copyrights always religiously. Do it every week if you have to.
Now, that means going to the feds and actually...
It means filling out a form on the web and giving them $30.
Okay.
Or maybe it's 35 now. I think it might have gone up. What that does is it turns a copyright into something that you have a license to dispute into a real weapon in court.
Mm-hmm.
And because if you have a registered copyright, registered before what the bad thing happened, is they have to pay all your expenses.
Mm, okay. And that's something you failed to do?
Huge difference. Who knew? I didn't know it was important.
And you didn't do that with this case then?
I didn't do it. I didn't do it in time. And now we're doing it.
Okay,
but
right.
Just in case he comes back. But okay. But I didn't know. So to all of your listeners, if you have a piece of software you care about, just call up the Copyright Office, copyright.gov, and file the thing. It's not that hard.
And tell me if I'm wrong, but I think the difference is if you register, you're allowed treble damages plus fees as opposed to just simply actual expenses, right? Actual loss?
They have to pay your fees, and if you win, of course.
Yeah.
If you lose, that's a bad thing.
Right.
And you don't have to prove monetary damages. There's this thing called statutory damages.
Right, that's the difference.
Which greatly simplifies the whole process. You can still prove monetary damages if you can, but you don't have to. And all of a sudden, the need for experts and the need for all sorts of certifications and things just vanish.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So
and the ability of lawyers to fight on your side for a long time goes up a lot.
I wonder how many open source projects aren't doing that. That sounds like I think you're the first person I've heard say that. So this is really interesting. I really appreciate that. So that's item one.
It would have changed my case a lot.
Okay.
The second thing is, I don't want to provoke a religious war, but pick one of the top three or four licenses and use it.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not perfect, even if it's not exactly what you want, pick the one that's closest and use it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I had been writing, if I'd used my own license, none of those people would have been able to help me.
Right, right.
And the fact that I used artistic license was just enough to get them involved. If I had been using BSD, GPL, basically any of the OSI licenses, that would be okay.
Okay.
But that's real important because somebody may come after you, and this is a good way to do it.
So don't make up your own license, especially don't make up your own license and not consult a lawyer.
Oh, well, even if you consult a lawyer, you know, you can count the number of expert lawyers in this area on the fingers of one hand.
Sure. Okay, cool.
And you know, your cousin-in-law who's a commercial lawyer isn't going to be able to help you.
Right, right. Okay, great.
And the third one is don't give up. You've got a lot of friends out there. You just have to find them. It's surprising how often this kind of thing happens with little software projects where somebody feels threatened by open source.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people who will help. I was so happy that there were so many people who would help.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if somebody threatens you, call around and get people to help. What we have to do in the open source movement in general, I don't just mean model trains, but I mean small projects, is develop a communal immune system for fighting this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
and we can help each other.
And so primarily you're talking about contacting like the EFF and the Software right. Freedom Law Center and a few places like that, right?
That's right. Don't just sit there and take it. Ask those people for help.
Did you use social media in the midst of this? Were you like tweeting about this, blogging about it, or was that sort of, would that have been counterproductive?
Yeah. This is tricky. Yeah. What I didn't want is for the JMRI community to turn into a flame fest over this.
Okay.
I wanted the developers and the model railroaders to be able to talk about developing software and making trains. But there's a tricky thing here because I also had to raise money from them, mm-hmm. and I had to get their help finding documents and things like that. So you walk sort of a funny line,
mm-hmm.
and the line I walked is I only really talked about it every couple months. I didn't give a blow-by-blow account as things went along.
Did people have a sense, though, of the urgency and depth to which this was for you?
Maybe not as much as – that's why I have this third point of call for help.
Mm-hmm.
I think I avoided calling for help publicly. I should have done more of that.
Okay, good.
Because there are people who will rally behind you and who will help in most of these communities.
Those are three very important points. I'm glad you brought those up. I wouldn't have picked that out of the rest of this conversation. So that's really good that you brought that up. So at this point, it's sort of behind you, except for the financial burden, or is there still stuff going on forward from here that you have to worry about?
Well, I'm really hoping that it's behind me.
Okay.
Somebody is doing weird stuff on Wikipedia about this, and I'm hoping that's not Katzer. But you know, I want to get back to model trains and software. This took a whole bunch of my time,
mm-hmm.
and I'd much rather spend that time on other things. So yeah. I'm hoping it's behind. I have four. I'm sitting in my office right now. I have five boxes of prior art that I have to mail back to people. Things they loaned me.
Okay.
And there's going to be paperwork for another month or two. I'm still writing thank you letters to people, and that's going to go on for probably another month or two because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
But it is. I'm hoping that it's behind me.
This is not
what I wanted to be. I did not want to be the legal point man for open source. That was not my intention.
I don't think any pioneer actually ever expects the arrow through the head.
Yeah.
They want to just be the guy riding the horse in at the end of the day. They don't want to have the
yeah,
arrow
right.
to the head.
They're riding off to the sunset without the arrows. That's the thing.
Yeah, incredible.
And, you know, but so as open source, here I think I'm philosophizing maybe a little too much, but as open source gets more and more away from computing and more into everyday life,
mm-hmm.
right, this project is mostly model railroading. It's not so much about software. We're not writing a web server. We're writing tools for trains. So as you start seeing open source projects to write software for use in the kitchen, to write, you know, stuff that isn't mostly about computers,
right.
I think we'll see more and more of this, though. I think we'll see more and more of these very involved little communities that are sort of clueless about the software parts of it.
Okay.
And it'll be interesting to see how they protect themselves.
Wow, this is incredible. And open hardware, too, by the way. So, you know, all this
very
stuff
similar
is...
kind of thing, mm-hmm. right? My son is really into open hardware. And he builds little. He's not very old. He's 12, but he's in contact with people all over the world that don't realize he's only 12,
mm-hmm.
unless they're all only 12.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But they exchange designs. They build things and stuff like that. And we're starting to hear people threatening those guys too.
Does it ever end?
Well, no, it never ends because there'll always be people who are like that.
So I just want to wrap this up by saying, yes, you still have a financial burden. Can people contribute? Do you have like a PayPal account set up or something?
Yeah, there is a PayPal. It's jmri@pacbell.net. There's a button on the JMRI webpage that takes you right to the place, and I would really appreciate it. I'm still tens of thousands of dollars in the hole.
Well, I'm sure some of our listeners will probably have been motivated by this story, if not already brought to tears about it, because it's just been a I could completely sympathize having my own $250,000 legal fees situation of my own. So,
well, I hope yours has ended. Have you been able to put yours behind you?
Yeah, I'm actually. This all happened 10 years ago, and I've been expunged already and everything, so it's all in the history now. But I completely sympathize with all of this. You know, I learned that it's not the justice system; it's the legal system.
Yes, that's very true.
Very important phrase to learn.
And having facts on your side is not the only issue.
And that you know, most geeks don't understand the legal system because they think it's logical.
Yeah.
And it is the opposite of logical. It is all about chess moves and positioning and junk.
Well,
so
we lost an early ruling, which actually hurt the case, but we were able to eventually overcome it. Mm-hmm. And that was when my education really began, because in design, if you are I'm an experimental physicist, an experiment, if something is a little bit wrong and goes the wrong way, you just fix it and do it again and it's okay.
Right.
In the legal system, we lost this ruling because we had literally put two words wrong in something. And eventually you can correct it, and that's what the appeal system is for, and it was a preliminary ruling, et cetera, et cetera. But it cost us a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the costs associated with that and stuff like that. And I looked at that and said, you know, the legal system is just not like engineering. It's Mm-mm. just completely different. And all my instincts about how to do things are not helpful. You really need to be aware of the fact. Engineers, software designers need to be aware of the fact that the system works differently. Wow. And stay away from it.
Indeed. Well, especially don't be at the wrong end of the legal system.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the dangerous part. Well, Bob, I really appreciate you taking your time out of your day to talk to our audience about what's gone on for you. And I hope a few people listening now will feel motivated to help defray a little bit more of your costs. That's it's a noble thing to have done what you did. And I'm glad it came out as well as it did for you. It could have been a lot worse.
But, you know, once you get put in a position where you can't quit, you can sleep at night because you just have to do it.
Yep. And this is also something I think, you know, it's interesting that now, in essence, we have a court decision at the appeals court level, at least, that open source licenses are enforceable.
That's correct. And that's important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you again. This has been Bob Jacobson talking to us from Berkeley, California. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Wow. What an amazing story. And you can find out more about Bob Jacobson and the JMRI project and all of the legal documents at jmri.org. I've just got to say, you know, having been through similar circumstances, that Bob Jacobson is my hero. And, you know, putting it very directly, he took one for the team. He spent a lot of his recent personal and professional time just fighting the good fight, doing what he had to do to make sure that the legal precedents set by this case allow for the things that we've been arguing for years in the free and libre open source software community. And mostly that open source licenses can be enforceable even without any money exchanging hands. And in the process of doing this, he spent a lot of his personal blood, sweat, and tears and his personal professional time to make this happen, and a lot of financial burden resulting from this. And I know there's a lot of you listening out here that have listened to this story and were moved. And I really would urge you, you know, we have a big enough audience for this show that if everyone just right now went to the jmri.org website, there's a support this project button in the lower left-hand corner. If you just donated $1 each, it would almost completely wipe his debt free. And I really would just urge you to do that. And it's not tax deductible, but it's just a buck, okay? You know, don't worry about it. It's just a buck. If you want to make a large donation and you're in the U.S. and you want to make it tax deductible, I'm going on a limb here, and I think that we can, wearing my linuxfund.org hat at the moment, I think we can probably work out a way to make that a tax deductible contribution for you as well. Because this is clearly something that is important for the entire open source community. It's really fundamental that our licenses work the way we intend them to. Wow. And I just want to, again, thank Bob Jacobson for taking the time out of his day to come on and talk about his story. And coming up on Floss Weekly, we have a number of very interesting guests as well. We have Sean Pierce coming on next week talking about Garrett, which is the Java clone of the Git software, the version control software we talked about a number of years ago. Java version also includes a built-in bug tracker, and it's the one that's being used by the Android project. So we'll have him on next week talking about that. And then a very special show coming up in a couple of weeks. We have none other than Scott Maxwell and Paola Belluta, who drive the rovers. They drive the rovers. They make the Mars rovers, anyway. Not just any rovers, the Mars rovers. They're also very intimately connected with all the software that's being used to do that. They can talk to us about the use of open source at NASA and JPL and all sorts of things. That should be a really fun show. Ryan Levengood's coming on the week after that to talk about the Haiku OS, I guess. Haiku, yes. Matt Ray's going to talk about Xenos. Actually saw him last week at Texas Linux Fest. Good presentation. Jonathan Simpson after that, talking about the PDPC, which is in charge of things like Freenode, the great IRC network that most of us use, and GeekNIC conferences, FOSCON conferences, and so on. If you're watching the live show or want to watch the live show, we have moved to a new time to more better accommodate our European guests and also sometimes our East Coast guests. We're now going to be live on the Twit Network, still on Wednesdays, but at 9:30 Pacific time. So that's 4 hours earlier than before. That would be 12:30 Eastern. And, you know, I haven't done the math yet to tell what Zulu time it is, but just subtract 4 hours from when it was before, and you'll be able to watch us then. So I look forward to having you in the live audience when you get a chance. You can see our upcoming guest list at twit.tv/floss, linked from there. And you can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. So check that out, and you'll see stuff like that. We'll have some very special co-hosts coming up soon for some of the shows. I will announce that as time permits. But in the meanwhile, again, go to jmri.org. Please make a donation and help Bob Jacobson out. I really would appreciate that. So we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.